The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hello, Stephanomics here, and this week, a special insight on China from someone who has a quite different perspective on the country than many of the economists and policymakers we've had pontificating about it on this show. Kei Yu Jin, a professor at the London School of Economics, who's lived for some time in London but grew up in China and still spends part of the year there. In fact, she's in Beijing now, but she's kindly joined me for a conversation about her new book, The New China Playbook. Kei Yu Jin, thank you so much for being with us. As I said, it's sort of relatively rare to have someone with both feet so firmly planted in both China and the West. And I think the other sort of particular thing about you is that you have, you know, personally experienced, you and your family, the extraordinary transformation of China's society and economy over the past 30 or 40 years. And you start and you end the book with that. So I think before we talk about some of the themes in your book, tell us a little bit about your personal story of your family and how different things might have been for them if you hadn't had the kind of changes in China that we've seen.
Well, first of all, great to be with you, Stephanie. Thanks for this opportunity. Yes, I think me, my family, but just it's only really one of so many Chinese families who have gone through this incredible economic transformation in China. My parents worked in the fields during the Cultural Revolution. They were able to move to Beijing and create this life for me because of the amazing meritocracy and the Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening up since the late 1970s that afforded so many Chinese really an economic opportunity. And so my parents would be the first, again, among many in their generation, to have really seen their future and their fate go from, just from the farms to the city and even to the West. I grew up in China, but I was an exchange student in high school in the U.S., and when I went to the U.S., it was very interesting because everyone knew I was from China in high school, and they could only talk about or ask me about Taiwan, Tibet, human rights. But by the time I got to college, a few years later, people were learning Mandarin. And a few years later, when we were graduating, people moved to China even to look for jobs. So that was a personal experience, but again, so typical among so many Chinese.
You start the book just sort of talking about the house that you were first born into. And also you mentioned, I think, at the end that it was really the good performance of your father in his exams that meant that you left the countryside at all.
Yes, I was born in an 11 square meter apartment, which at that time was really a luxury. And we had communal kitchens. And my father had absolutely no family background. He was the son of factory workers, in down and south. And he was among the first generation to take the graduate examination, national graduate examination, which Deng Xiaoping reinstalled and got himself into Beijing. And then, the rest is history.
And we're all used to our own sort of parents or grandparents saying, I remember when, but it's the drama of that when you're talking about the pace of change in China. Is it something that you talk about around the dinner table, or is it just passed without comment at this point?
What we do talk about often that my parents like to remind me is how grateful I should be, and we should all be, to Deng Xiaoping's policies and economic and opening up, and how difficult it was for the Chinese, and really how grateful they should be to the country and to the great leaders that have given everybody an opportunity. And I think that is a very, a common feature in the discussion of all Chinese families.
And it's interesting, even in the way you say that, you have pointed up one of the great things that people outside China find so hard to understand, that sort of deep sense of deference and gratitude that is so widely shared by people across China is kind of one of those, you know, we don't spend very much of our time giving thanks for our leaders and their great decisions. And just in terms of the numbers, you had a great stat. It's just a good way of summarizing it. You mentioned that over the years of the Industrial Revolution were considered to be amazing because they improved the standard of living by 75% within a single lifetime. But the growth rates in China, as you point out, mean that many Chinese will see living standards rise 75-fold, so 7,500%. I thought that just really kind of put it into perspective. Okay, so your book, you mentioned the phrase several times, reading China in the original. That what do we miss by not doing that, by not seeing China through Chinese eyes?
You know, culturally, historically, China comes from a very different place. And we keep on judging China for what it is through the Western lens. We'll get China wrong. We'll predict China wrong, as we have many times. We will not see their view of the Chinese people. And so whether you're a policymaker or a student learning about China, or businesses wanting to engage or disengage with China, just having that bit of a cultural and historical nuance and understanding how that really vastly different economic model, political economy model works would be just so important.
So what's an example of a misunderstanding of China that is potentially dangerous at the current time?
Well, I think it starts, you know, from the misunderstanding of China's ambitions and goals in the world. There is a view that China is trying to displace the U.S., for example, but it is actually trying to overcome a middle income trap. We're talking about its economic goal in the next 15 years or so to be reaching $23,000 of per capita income. We're talking about 600 million people who's living under $300 of monthly income, still needing to reach international standards middle income. And I think for the Chinese, they believe, well, first of all, the Chinese people have a right to prosperity, have a right to attain the technological prowess that all developing countries and emerging markets want to have someday. I don't think it's stupid enough to want to displace the U.S. For some reason, because it's not really currently feasible. But also, you know, less dangerous, but just so important and interesting. Every time I mention this, I think people are just so surprised, even extremely cosmopolitan, well-educated people, is how the political economy works in China. People think about China as a centralized state with, you know, with almighty control, but actually the economic model is a very decentralized model. I call this the mayor economy. In my book, and it just goes to show that all the economic transformations, the reforms we talked about, the innovation, controlling pollution, and really just building these amazing unicorns, so many unicorns, hundreds of unicorns a year in China, scattered all throughout China, rather than just focused on Beijing and Shenzhen and Shanghai, all because of the mayors, so to speak. That economic decentralization is so far none of, you know, my friends have understood.
Of course, what people look at and what they think of when they're sort of focused on the control of the power of the state is the control over political activity and to some extent the power control of individual thought, when you think of all the surveillance, the great firewall preventing people in China from seeing everything on the internet from outside China. I mean, it's hard to argue that it isn't a strong central state.
Politically, it's a very strong central state. But I think the question that you've raised here, there's also a bit of misunderstanding. There's actually a very, very dynamic, more than we believe, dynamic civic debate on social media in China. And apart from a few taboo issues, there are things ranging from organizing protests around China. You know, as an example, there was something like more than 11,000 protests just over land use rights, not to mention so many other protests. And they allowed that. There is criticism. One of the top key hot issues is criticisms of local officials, calling them out in corruption, or if they had a mistress that was found somewhere, that was spotted somewhere, or expensive watches. There's a huge amount of pushback. Again, these stories don't get reported, but for instance, in the city of Hangzhou down south, you know, people complained about the data collection and data privacy issues from a public park. And then they canceled the whole thing. They canceled the facial recognition ticket system. So you're actually able to push the local officials to change, and relatively rapidly if there's wide discontent. Now, of course, there's some things that you don't hear, and there is censorship on the social media platform, the highly, highly sensitive political issues, which not every single Chinese citizen talks about. But again, there are also loopholes. You know, some of them would post during midnight, and then by the time the officials in charge will wake up, it was already, you know, everywhere on the internet. So it's not that easy to implement. But I agree with you, Stephanie. There has been tighter control and more surveillance in the years. That's for sure true. But to see the complete picture, we have to recognize that it's not a bunch of just 1.4 billion people having no voice at all.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
We've had a situation where over 30 or 40 years, China has made itself, as we discovered recently, indispensable to global manufacturing production. Even people who don't think they're dependent on China have found, you know, actually there's, you know, some number of parts that come through China or are made in China. And that's obviously animated President Biden's push to diversify production globally and to some extent decouple. I'm sort of fascinated when China obviously would be proud of what it's achieved. Is it, does it think that the rest of the world was a bit foolish to allow themselves so easily to become hooked on Chinese production? Does it inculcate a sort of lack of respect? It sort of sometimes feels, we sort of wonder whether China's kind of laughing at us behind our backs for having got ourselves in this situation.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I think globalization was the best thing that happened to China, and allowing China to embrace it. And unless we really kind of believe that somehow we ought to have 3/4 of the people in the world living in abject poverty, I just don't see any rationale against this view of deglobalization and decoupling. And we can't forget about the 80% of the people still living in developing world in today's world.
Thinking about China right now, and obviously people are looking at China's economy, feeling a bit concerned about the slowdown we've seen in the last few months and some of the very deep-seated challenges that the government faces, for example, in the real estate, trying to reduce the amount of investment in real estate without seriously undermining the economy, given that property has been played such a big part in growth. How do you judge the way Xi Jinping and his new administration are sort of handling those challenges facing the economy?
Well, first of all, the overarching mood is a return of pragmatism. Pragmatism, just the basic principle for Chinese people all these years, and still not forgotten, still most important, despite everything we think about security and nationalism, pragmatism is actually what the Chinese people want the most. So it's kind of ironic that the economy has to suffer that much before the return of pragmatic goals. Once again, keep your head down, make GDP, create jobs, and that's what the government is focused on.
Sorry, just to interrupt, when you say the return of pragmatism, so what was it returning from? What have we seen?
Well, we had
the previous
seen
years.
A lot of, yeah, we especially in the last year or so during COVID and during the Party Congress, there was a lot of mention of security. There was a lot of mention of the threats that have encircled China, external, internal, pandemic, and how security was really the most important thing for China. And we're going to see security being continue to be important, but it will be a pendulum swing between the economy and security and sometimes economics wars. And as you mentioned, Stephanie correctly pointed out, the real economics difficulty right now is to find something to replace the property sector, which broadly accounted for a third of China's GDP. And even though resources are directed towards now hard tech, now the high tech, now towards, you know, things like EVs and renewables, that's just not enough in the short term to get the GDP numbers to create the kind of jobs that are required for social stability and to reduce youth unemployment, which is north of 20% currently. So what could that be? They're still finding the way. So in the short term, we really might see a slow economy. I don't think there's going to be a collapse or any sort. I think the government will do enough to reach the goal of reaching $23,000 per capita income in 2035. But I wouldn't keep my hopes up for really spectacular performance.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned that our chief economist, Tom Orlick, was saying, you know, just a few years ago, it was very difficult to imagine China not rapidly overtaking the US as the world's biggest economy. But we're now seeing, as we update our new forecasts and think about downside and upside scenarios, and there's lots of scenarios under which that great moment of China overtaking the US is delayed a long time, and somewhere it doesn't happen at all.
Well, Stephanie, I think it's true with these scenarios, but China needs to only needs to grow 1.5 percentage points faster than the U.S. to overtake it in a little more than 10 years. And I think it's actually pretty plausible, given that it's all about relative performance. But I think it really depends on how you get there, right? So just in terms of nominally achieving a size that's larger than the U.S., I'm actually more optimistic than those projections. But I don't think it necessarily means all that much unless you really raise the standards of living, unless China really is able to come up with its own, you know, high-tech independence, which, again, I think is going to be the story of the next decade. And the economic growth is actually real rather than just the macro numbers.
You talk quite a lot about the crucial importance for the continued support for the government and for the party is that that it deliver stability, that it deliver rising prosperity. Is China ready for a situation in which we don't see the kind of dramatic economic growth we've seen, or indeed we may see, you know, quite meager growth over the next few years.
I think one group to watch is the younger generation. You know, imagine that you've done everything in your life and your family has spent every penny of their savings on your education, and you get a bachelor's degree and you're in 20s and you don't even have a first job. I mean, that's seriously concerning for the Chinese families and therefore for the government. And so how do you solve that high youth unemployment problem, I think, comes before many other things, because remember that Chinese families, another cultural misunderstanding that I highlight in my book, is that it's a dynastic, you know, family. It's not about maximizing one's individual consumption, as the Western canonical economic model always assumes, but it's about, you know, intergenerational altruism, maximizing household consumption, or saving for your children, or saving so that you can support your parents in older age. None of that, very little of that, is featured in these basic workhorse frameworks in the Western economics. But that is just the basic foundation. So when the Chinese families are unhappy collectively, then I think it's a potential threat to social stability. Now, we saw how rapid things changed at the end of last year during the pandemic, when China opened up so much earlier than expected because of resistance. I mean, that just goes to show the people has enormous power, and the sea of the people is really what keeps the float of leadership, keeps that boat of leadership afloat. We're not seeing necessary signs of social instability because of the economy yet. It really depends on whether that pragmatic attitude will hold in the coming years. There's a gap of 25 million jobs in manufacturing the next 3 years needing to be filled. There is a 300,000 talent gap just in semiconductor sectors alone. But the real chasm is that there's a difference between expectations and reality. And the Chinese students, all of them getting this bachelor's degree, wants to have a high earning job in finance and real estate, except that there are not that many jobs in finance and real estate.
You talk about the new generation and them having different expectations and potentially just very different individual experiences from their family. One of the basic things that the West has been surprised about, rightly or wrongly, is that there hasn't been more of a move towards more democratic, more individualistic society as a market economy has taken hold in China. At the bottom of that is a sort of continued belief that as you move to a more service-oriented, so service sector-based economy, which structurally they have to do, and as they move to having more of the growth of the economy driven by consumption, not investment, which I think the government also recognises, a country, and certainly as you try and develop more and more technological innovation and you are more on the kind of frontier of technology rather than catching up to the rest of the world, that to us spells a need for a more individualistic society, one where people are more likely to feel oppressed by a very strong single party government. So do you not recognize that as a possibility, that some of those cultural traditions will come right up against the economy as it is today and will be in the next 10, 20 years?
The relationship with authority is something that is very different from the West, and it's kind of ingrained in the Chinese people since we were young. The relationship with our parents and our Confucian family, the relationship with our teachers, and of course the relationship with authorities, the government. The Chinese people have always had to learn to balance that desire of exerting one's individual free will and behaving in a community, deference and collaboration and cooperation with the government or with your authorities. But I think, Stephanie, at the bottom line, if you're asking, you know, if the question is if the Chinese people want to have a more free and open society, I think the answer is a resounding yes. And I think whether it's the new generation, and even much more so the older generation, like those in the 1960s, they aspire democratic values. But I also have to say they're not that inspired by its Western incarnation of democracy, because they would be, you know, observing the fact that there's so much bickering over the U.S. They'd be wondering why a society that champions rights don't give all the women rights to end unwanted pregnancies. And they would be, you know, looking at the gun violence and the potholes on the streets in the U.S. And they would be wondering. Now, that was not necessarily the case in the 80s and 90s when the Chinese people was more mesmerized by the U.S. and were very deeply impressed. So at that point, you saw many Chinese people aspiring to that that society and that openness and that freedom, etc. But I think less and less so, and this is very clear from the surveys, international surveys of the different generations, the new generations have no appetite to have an overhaul of their own system. And yes, I think things have become difficult in the last few years, last 2 years, especially by the end of the pandemic. But over the last decade, the Chinese people have been more proud, not less proud, and more sure of their system, the power of their system, than compared to many years ago. Again, I'm not saying what is good and wrong, right or wrong, but this is, I'm just stating the facts of how the Chinese people feel when they look at democracies for inspiration outside of China.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I mean, you say in your book that understanding Chinese thinking doesn't mean endorsing it in its entirety. I have to admit, kind of as you read it, it sort of feels like you do pretty much endorse it in its entirety. I mean, even the mistakes that you identify or the economic problems that you identify, you know, you then sort of later in the book explain how they have been reversed or remedied by a very agile and, flexible response by the state. So I guess I'm just wondering, what do you think that the other countries have done better than China? Where do you think China needs to learn lessons?
I think if you felt a sense of endorsement, it was an endorsement of a certain kind of model in the early stages of development, not eternally. And if there's one thing I think it is important and proved to be repeatedly crucial for countries to jump out of poverty and slowly tread on the middle income path towards rich income, it's high quality state capacity. And China's model was one form of delivering high quality state capacity, not the only and unique form. But I think it does have certain developmental lessons. And just take a solid example. Recently, China became the largest producer and consumer of EVs within a decade. How was it able to do that? Well, it wouldn't have been able to do that without the government installing 4 million EV charging stations around the country. Compared to China, the U.S. is 140,000. And it wouldn't have been able to do it so quickly if the local government officials were not so avidly working on coordinating supply chains all around China, you know, gathering battery makers, control systems, manufacturers, et cetera, all together. That requires high quality state capacity.
But can you think of anything that China got wrong that America's got right?
Oh, yes. And you mentioned the thing that other countries done well. I think, you know, there are many countries we always talk about getting to Denmark, even in the West, you know, the kind of the lower levels of inequality, the social goods and public goods that have been delivered to the people, the general level of happiness. I think we should all aspire to get to Denmark, but Denmark is also kind of tiny, if I may say so. So it's obviously more difficult for bigger countries like the US and China. And eventually we're going to see what's going to happen to India, right? And so I think all of these large economies have their challenges because of the complexity of society. I will say that if we observe South Korea or Japan closer as neighbors, you know, they are good models of relatively good liberal democracies that have worked. But I think that the real issue really is China is going to become much more complex social, even more than now. And that's going to be the real challenge for the country and for the government, because in the last 40 years, people were centered on one goal, and that was economic growth and seeing your income grow up and up. And that was what that was the focal point of the nation. Everybody was rallied around that goal. Now, as you reach middle income, as you reach a richer income, country level income, people are going to want different things. They're going to want their preferences to be reflected ultimately in political decisions. And so I think that will be a challenge. And how can you manage? It's going to be much more difficult to manage a complex society with a wide range of needs and desires rather than just the economy. So I think that would really be the challenge for China.
I'm so sorry to talk to you, but I just find it kind of interesting that you can't, I mean, you, as you say, there's the two big countries and there's lots of things that are different about them, but I just, it seems like you can't think of something that China's got wrong.
Digressing. No, look, the Chinese people are absolutely mesmerized by entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and the technological innovations like ChatGPT. They are obsessed with them. The new generation are obsessed with them. And how do you have a society that can allow these great things to happen is what absolutely, I think the US would be ahead of China for a very, very long time. And if we're talking about basically breakthrough technologies, it's in America, it's not in China yet. Mm. That comes down to so many things, so many factors, and not least civil society and its openness and its relationship between the universities and industries, and that free flow of ideas, absolutely crucial. And that's for sure something that the U.S. Has gotten right.
Thank you. My final question. Do you find the students at LSE very different from students you teach? It's an obvious question, but I'm just fascinated. I mean, when you talk about this sort of tradition, the way people deal with their teachers and everything else, do you find the British students terribly insubordinate and cheeky?
No. I think not at all. I think you, each student is different, but I think the Chinese students come into my office and often start with what their parents think, which is, surprising, especially when it comes to their future. But good students are always great students because of their ability to think out of the box. And we see that whether you're Chinese or Brits. And I think the new generation, as I mentioned, they're much more, so to speak, individualistic and selfish in the eyes of the authorities. But that's a good thing. You know, they want to consume more, they want to borrow more, so they're going to change the economy. But I still think the roots are culturally deeply rooted in China, that local, the relationship with the local culture. You know, in the last decade or so, 80% of the students who have studied abroad have returned to China. And if really China wasn't a really great place, how could these people who had jobs at Microsoft and Google and Facebook give them up to go back to pursue their future in China? So it can't be as bad as we think. In fact, they have been rather optimistic about their nation's future.
Okay, Eugene, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephanie.
That's it. That's it for this episode of Stephanomics. Next week, we will have more. In the meantime, you can get a lot more economic insight and news from the Bloomberg Terminal website or app. This episode was produced by Magnus Henriksen, Yang Yang, and Sama Sadi, with special thanks to Professor K.U. Jin. The executive producer of Stephanomics is Molly Smith, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Sage Bowman.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.